The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Gold and silver can be for years on the wrong side. I happen to agree in this case that our cycles, they were bottoming by the end of the summer, and we faced some short-term up moves and made some small percentages, and it's getting very close of putting in a major low.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney, and that voice you just heard was Charles Nenner. We're going to go to some clips of that conversation with Charles Nenner here toward the end of the program. David, you have the office read a book every month or so, and we get together, we discuss the book, we have pizza, and it's really a great time for an office of people who think about the markets and think about life a lot to get together and apply someone else's viewpoint. And the book that you have us reading this month is a book called Deep Survival by Lawrence Gonzalez.
There's very few things that I find more satisfying than building a library, growing a library. And in this case, it's building out the libraries of everybody in the office. And you're right, we've got these lively conversations around ideas. Sometimes we agree with, sometimes we completely disagree with, but it's a part of our continuing education. And you're right, Gonzalez writes a book not about survival tactics, but about the emotional and psychological profile of people who do well or don't do well under pressure.
Well, you know, I love a book that's written by a man who's trying to solve just something that's really eating at him. And he had a father that had been a bomber. He had flown in bombers in World War II, and the bomber got shot completely out of the sky, and only the fuselage fell to the ground thousands of feet, yet his father had survived. Then he had gone to a concentration camp, and then he later became a prominent scientist. And Lawrence, you can tell, the author of this book, was fascinated by what was it that made him survive and so many other people in lesser circumstances die in a situation like that.
Yeah, so to see what appears to be accidents of circumstance or what have you, as he lays out the book, he says, no, quite frankly, mistakes that are made, which seem extraordinary, are actually quite common. And so it should be a great discussion.
Well, and one of the key concepts, and I think this applies to today's discussion, Dave, is when you read a book called Deep Survival, maybe you're thinking it's how to start a fire with flint or wood. That's not what this is about. This is about life. And one of the things that he probably points out better than anyone that I know of is being lost is not knowing the location you're in. It's a transformation of the mind. And he said that there are many people who go to the woods and they don't know exactly where they are. I mean, most of us don't know exactly where we are most of the time. But he said, being lost is not a location. It's a transformation. What happens is when a person's mind doesn't match the map that they're in, they have a mental idea of where they should be. And if it doesn't match, they start to realize that they might be lost. And they have a tendency, a lost person has a tendency to bend the map. Survival practitioners and people in search and rescue use that phrase. They'll bend the map to make it fit what they want. And Dave, I'm seeing this in the markets. The central banks of the world right now, especially the Fed, the intervention of the Fed, they're bending the map to where people believe there's no longer risk in the market, just certainty.
Well, right. And if I could just say one more thing about that book, if you wanted sort of a twofer coming into the holidays, I would read that. I would also read, if you haven't, Jason Zweig's book, Your Money and Your Brain. This was another office read from about 5 years ago. But the combination of those two, looking at sort of brain science and emotional response to pressure, you have the same kinds of emotional pressures in the marketplace. And understanding what's going on, knowing yourself, is very critical in the context of making financial decisions.
Well, and he likens emotion to a horse that a jockey would ride, and your brain
as the jockey,
the intellect. And the thing is, he said there's a balance there. You're not going to eliminate emotion, but you certainly better have a jockey on the horse to control it.
No, but what you just mentioned in terms of the central bank's role today, they really are the linchpin in the financial markets. And you can see this through the various quantitative easing programs, Operation Twist thrown in the mix there too. And it really is interesting. The Fed today is trapped. And their activity has been the linchpin. Now, the linchpin of the linchpin is that they have to have buy-in and confidence in those central bank policies actually working. What has worked and what hasn't? On the one hand, you've had asset price inflation, and so they can pat themselves on the backs for that because they're essentially creating a new bubble. And that's how they've dealt with the problems of the last 15 years, is rather than create structural reforms within the economy,
they just fuel a bubble and try to keep it from popping.
And that's precisely what they're doing today. Now, part of what they're trying to also do is create inflation. And this is a very interesting thing because increasing inflation was never really the role central bank was supposed to play. In fact, if you look at the European Central Bank and the German influence within the ECB, quite the opposite. Price stability is their goal, not increasing the rate of inflation. And I guess what you really have to come to terms with is that we've entered into debtism. It is a new realm and a new sphere of existence, if you will. And debtism, an economy which is contingent or based on an ever-increasing expansion of debt, as we discussed a few weeks back with Richard Duncan, we now have the issue of having to deal with the consequences of having too much debt. I mean, consider this. We have had $100 trillion worth of government debt accumulated globally. $100 trillion. 40% of that has accumulated in the last 6 years. 40% of that in terms of global government debt. And so is it strange to encounter central banks wanting to increase inflation? Because quite frankly, the only way you get in front of that size mountain of debt is to inflate away the debt. And so to ever increase inflation now is a survival tactic.
Well, okay, but let me take the other side of this though, Dave. I'm looking at this and saying, okay, it's $100 trillion, but if I'm the average Joe out there with a stock portfolio, my stocks are going up. Why should I worry about that? It seems that central bank intervention has now eliminated risk in my portfolio.
Right. I guess if you understand what's at stake, yeah, this is a bit of a Ponzi scheme. It takes more and more money each time to get the job done. And we see this extreme dependence on central bank activity as you look at the U.S. stock market. So you may say, well, hey, let's just run with the bulls, make some money while we can. We'll always be smart enough to get out. Look at how dependent and how system dependent the market is today on Fed money printing. QE1. You know what happened when they ended QE1? Within 2 months, the stock market was down 13%. QE2. When it expired, just within a few weeks, the stock market was down 16%. We talked about this a couple of months before QE3 ended, but you know what we ended up with? A 9.8% decline before we had what is now known as the Bullard bounce. You know, Bullard stepped in and verbally intervened, and this is, again, we've got the verbal intervention, which caused a V-shaped recovery in the stock market. We had dropped over 1,400 points on the Dow and then quickly recovered to move to new highs subsequently, again, following Bullard's comments. What that implies to me is a system that is completely frail and is utterly dependent on these outside stimuli.
Well, you know, Richard Duncan last week said that, you know, QE1 was one size, QE2 had to be bigger, QE3 had to be bigger, and then he said QE4 has to happen. I mean, his belief is we're going to go maybe a quarter, 2 quarters. He didn't give the exact time, but we have to have continued QE because there's nothing really fundamentally supporting these rises.
Well, and that goes back to conversations that we've had with him for years now. Income, you have to have it rising for there to be economic growth. Jobs growth, you have to have it rising for there to be economic growth. Credit growth, 2.2% is his number. If you want to check in with Bill Gross, he doesn't take out the inflation variable, whereas Richard Duncan does. So Bill Gross would say you need credit growth of 4.5%. The only difference between Bill Gross and Richard Duncan is that Richard Duncan is going ahead and saying, well, we factored the inflationary. 2.2% is a real number, and Gross's is not adjusted for inflation.
But the system is designed exactly opposite what we teach our kids. And we've mentioned this in the past, that money doesn't grow on trees. Yet we have a Federal Reserve that says, oh yeah, we can print freely. That's the quantitative easing. The other concept that we try to teach our children is do not go into debt that is unpayable, that you'll never pay. And the Federal Reserve, and the way this thing runs at this point, is you have to print money and go further into debt. You're talking about credit growth, Dave. Whether it's Gross or Duncan, we have to go between 2 and 4% deeper into debt of our entire GDP just to survive. So we're running on debt.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Studies have shown that when you combine public and private debt, any number above 250% of GDP ends up being a tax on the economy. In other words, a little bit of debt early on in a debt growth cycle is okay. You can handle it, and it probably adds to growth in the economy. But you reach a threshold where maintaining the debt is costly in and of itself, and it actually begins to detract from total economic growth. 250% when you combine public and private debts together, that's the threshold where you begin to see a deleterious effect on the economy.
Like we saw in Argentina. I mean, Argentina
right.
was a great example to us of a country that's gone too far into debt. It's now in default, let's just say, and they're in 40% inflation. So it's the deterioration again of a system that we've never seen. Let's face it, Dave. This style of management, even though they say maybe this time it's different, maybe they're doing it right this time, it's never worked before.
Well, the pressure that we're seeing on the economy today is in large part because there's too much debt in the system. If 250% is the threshold, we're currently at 334%. And the pressure that you see in the economy as a result of having too much debt is not linear. So as we increase debt from this point forward, there's greater and greater pressure on the economy to just motor along, so to say, which would make sense why the Fed is targeting inflation, because that's the only solution to paying down this mountain of debt.
That brings up a question, though, Dave. All right, let's say that the person who agrees with everything we're saying right now, yes, we've got too much debt, we're printing too much money, but I have to try to earn an income on my money. I have to try to preserve what I have. And what I'm seeing, and again, I'm speaking for this person who's looking at it from the other side, saying, I have a limited amount of time here on earth, and I'm seeing my stock market go up, granted, for reasons that are not sound. Do we see, Dave, a mispricing of risk? I mean, is there any risk left in the market?
Well, sure. I mean, granted, there's a benefit to the asset price inflation, direct consequence of the central bank intervention, money printing on a grand scale, and a boost to asset prices. They've stated that as a goal. The hope was that that would translate into real economic growth, and it hasn't. So this issue of income is a very big one. Although national balance sheet has improved and household net worth has improved, 17% increase from the previous peak, we're now at $81 trillion in terms of household net worth, it's very interesting that it's the top 10% of households which have been the beneficiary, whereas 90% of households have actually seen a decrease in their net worth. And the bottom 50%, if you're looking at demographics, sort of lower middle class to lower class in the country, they've actually seen a decrease in their household net worth by 44%.
So we're seeing billionaires being made every day, but we're seeing everyone else really losing money.
And so this issue of income being a driver of economic growth, we are at levels in terms of national income, real adjusted for inflation rates of income, which we haven't seen since 1996. We're at 17 year ago levels in terms of income, and it's one of the reasons why there is a general concern in the marketplace. You know, take your straw poll, go to a friend's house around the water cooler at the office. How are people generally feeling about the economy? Grant you, if they've got a $2 million, $5 million, $20 million portfolio, and it's racing higher as a consequence of Fed levitation of the asset in question, great. They're happy. The polls that we see, whether they're Pew polls or other polls, 60 to 80% of the general public are saying the economy does not look hopeful. How is that possible when you've got the stock market at all-time highs? Well, I'll tell you how it's possible. The stock market reflects central bank activism. It reflects intervention in the marketplace and rank speculation by banks and Wall Street firms. All is well. That's what we're being told. And the average consumer knows, no, all is not well. I mean, you get that sense. The international CEO for Walmart said this recently. This is David Cheesewright. Everywhere I travel, I see tough economies and stretched consumers, and that hasn't changed through the course of this year. Walmart, I think, is a pretty good proxy for the man in the street. You haven't seen huge improvements in Walmart's numbers in a number of years. In fact, they've given lower revenue guidance, lower sales projections, 9 quarters in a row. It's very intriguing to me that a Tiffany's does well and a Saks Fifth Avenue does well, a Macy's does well, but guess what doesn't do well? guess where the average man, guess where the common man does some of his shopping, does a lot of his shopping. And it is an indication of no, not all is well.
Well, and we are all human. You know, when you're told that household income is rising or household savings is rising, and then you find that your own income is not, a lot of times the question isn't who's doing something wrong. It's what am I doing wrong? Maybe I need to be in the stock market, that type of thing. You know, Dave, you brought up 1996. Our incomes as a nation are back down to 1996 levels. Our debt as a nation was a quarter of what it was. Okay, so if we're back to 1996 levels of income, that debt has to be paid with revenues from that income. Yet, we were at $4 trillion in 1996 in debt, if I remember right. We're at 17, almost 18. Yep. At this point.
Now, this is the basic point. I mean, fiscally, this is a train wreck. And this is where any thinking person will listen to the Fed presidents hither and yon as they wax eloquent about raising rates by mid-year 2015. And if anyone is engaged, do you know what they're thinking? Do you know what they're processing? We can't afford to have rates increase. You look at that interest line item, and we don't have the revenues increasing sufficient to match an increase in interest rates. And we have a large percentage of our debt, which is financed on a very short-term basis, making it incredibly interest rate sensitive. So you could see a couple hundred billion, which is today about 9 to 10% of revenues, spiked and then dropped back again. We could see that at $400, $600, $800 billion in terms of a line item, which would represent north of 30% of all tax revenue. I mean, again, this is Argentine type numbers, and it's literally a stone's throw away.
Well, and just like in Argentina, okay, Kirchner did what she had to do, which was print money if you can't tax it. This is why ending QE3 and saying you're not going to have QE4 is pretty ridiculous.
But it does something very helpful for the marketplace. It communicates that they won and that they're in control and their policies worked.
Bad news is good news for the markets at this point. Anytime there's bad economic news, they get excited.
And it's the same language used at the end of QE1, QE2, and QE3. Nobody wanted to acknowledge how system dependent we were then to Fed money printing. And it's the problem of being debt addicted. Once you begin printing money, that is a road that's very difficult to get off of. It's one of the reasons why I'm very, very comfortable and very, very confident in owning precious metals. I think that is where you see extremes in terms of market sentiment that we haven't seen reflected since, say, 2011 or 2012. As gold and silver were at $49 an ounce and $1,920 respectively, and futures traders were very, very interested and active in the market, you had 96% of futures traders saying, we're in, we love it, we think it's the best investment going forward. What happens? At 96%, guess what you run out of? You run out of new buyers.
Right.
And the opposite is true today.
So you think we may be running out of sellers?
We're running out of sellers. Those same numbers from futures traders, there's only about 5% of people who are positive on the gold market. It's an extreme that has not been seen in 30 years.
Okay, but this is amazing, Dave. Not to cut you off, but the man who would never mention gold while he was a Federal Reserve chairman is one of those 5% at this point. Okay, 2 weeks ago, he said that he would be buying gold because in the next 5 years, it will be considerably higher.
Actually, 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years, a shorter time frame. So, yeah, now think about that, because between the lines, when an ex-Fed president says that interest rates and gold are going considerably higher, understand that that ex-Fed president is saying the Fed is going to, in the next 3 to 5 years, completely lose control. Do you understand that that's exactly what that means?
So that's the implied statement.
Yeah, if you needed a translation of Greenspan's gold and interest rates are moving considerably higher, he knows what he knows, what he knows, and it is that the Fed is in the process of losing control.
Okay, so for those who have bent the map and believe that risk has been eliminated from the market because of central bank intervention, what does that do? Does that create that transformation, you know, that lost transformation where panic ensues?
Every market needs a patsy, and I think the person selling gold and buying stocks today is that perfect market patsy. You don't understand that what you're subjected to is what every investor is subjected to, a tremendous amount of emotional pressure. What you have to do is try to make the best possible decisions you can in spite of overwhelming emotion. And guess what? Investors, if you're looking at Jason Zweig's book, Your Money and Your Brain, do the wrong thing at the wrong time almost all the time. And that is because it's easiest to operate on the basis of greed and fear and not be able to distinguish yourself from the market. What does that mean? What does that look like exactly? It means that it is easiest to buy gold as the price is going up. It is easiest to buy stocks as the prices of those assets are going up. Why? You have an immediate confirmation that you're on the right side of the trend. The price is moving up. And the opposite is true. So yes, the best purchase you'll make is actually the hardest one to make. The worst purchase you'll make is the easiest one to make. Does that make sense at all?
Well, it makes perfect sense. But Dave, because gold has broken down below 1180, okay, which was a support level, you're starting to see the one newsletter writer who's been selling more newsletters than anybody telling people they better panic, they better sell their gold because gold's just going down. It may be a newsletter selling ploy, but right now there are people who are scared who are believing him.
Listen, we know the deflation camp well. Robert Prechter's a good friend.
Right.
And I read the folks at Elliott Wave all the time. These guys are the brightest in the business.
And they've been strong deflationists for years.
And then you have some hack newsletter writers who can pull numbers out of whoever knows where.
Right.
And they can say whatever they want without supporting evidence, just on the basis of a theory. I will tell you, the Elliott Wave guys, even though I sometimes disagree with them, they provide supporting evidence for their position. And it's very interesting that the defining deflationist camp this last week sent a special interim report saying gold had bottomed.
Yeah.
Gold has bottomed on an interim basis, and they expect 14 to 1500 as the next price target.
And these are guys who have been preaching that gold was going to go down.
Right. So, I mean, just appreciate the larger context of deflationists. There are hairy dents out there who are newcomers to the deflation camp.
And they're selling newsletters.
They are selling newsletters. And guess what? Elliott Wave folks are selling newsletters as well. On the one hand, you've got math-driven models, which, again, provide some support and evidence. And then you've got just wild...
It's emotion-based.
Pull the numbers out of the air.
It is. It's emotion-based.
Right.
I mean, you can tell by his mailers that they're emotion-based. But, okay, given that, we also talked to even cycle analysts, guys who just look at cycles. They're completely neutral on every market. Now, Charles Nenner, you just talked to Nenner, and he has been a cyclical analyst for years. And he, you know, he started out as a medical doctor, Dave, and really found that his talent was in measuring cycles. He looked at the human body. He saw patterns. He went to the markets, he did the same thing, and worked for Goldman Sachs for years.
A couple of other banks in Europe before that, but then, yeah, about a 10-year stretch with Goldman Sachs and providing information for their in-house traders. Interesting cycle studies.
Yeah, and he's not necessarily looking at fundamentals, he's really just looking at charts. And I'd like to, Dave, if we could, just go back and replay some of the comments that Charles had to you when you had your discussion with him the other day.
And I wonder if you could comment on the impact of central bank interventions on cycles. This is an era of remarkable activism by central banks. And from that standpoint, you could say psychological manipulation. How does that impact cycles?
Well, let me explain to you. I have worked with big institutions. I mean, the institution who wanted to buy for $500 billion currency. And even during the day, wanted to know, shall we buy at 2 o'clock or 5 o'clock? Now, you can buy whatever you want, but if the cycle is against you, it's not going to help. So these comments are being made when the cycles are positive. And they only make them because the cycles are positive. It's not that there's a Freudian father figure who takes care of us. These people, like Greenspan was an example, are as much part of the whole society as the other people. And it's an illusion to think that it happened because they said something. No, they said something because the cycle forced them to be positive. And even if they would have said nothing, the market would have gone up because of the cycle. Now, if you will look at my latest performance on CNBC, I was on the New York Stock Exchange 2 days before, and we were at 2016 on the S&P. And it says, what do you think? I says, well, my target long time is 2020, only 4 points away. Cycles are topping today. We're totally in cash. And look what happened. The market crashed. 10%, the Russell did much more. And now suddenly all the guys come out of woodwork and explain why it happened. So why didn't they tell us that before it happened? So we tell things before it happened, and all those ideas why it happened has nothing to do with it. So then we came up with a price target of 1810 on the S&P, and we went to 1814, and that was the target. So then it goes up again. So it means that psychologically, if people say, oh, it goes down, 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 and at a certain moment, they all feel, well, now it's a bargain. How that works, I remember when I was in gymnastics, when I was in school, and you were in the ropes, and you go up the rope. At a certain moment, everybody stopped at the same level, looked down, says, well, I'm a bit high over here. I'm not going high in the rope. So that's how it works with the market. The market goes up and down, and at a certain level, people, for what instinct they have, it's the animal instinct or conscious that the psychiatrist Jung is talking about, they feel, oh, now it's time to buy. And then the papers, of course, have to come up with the reasons. So they come up all kinds of reasons. But we always prove that since we have the target and the date before, that has nothing to do with the news that comes out, because how could we have known? But it's such an emotional problem for the people to take over that insight in how the world functions that only really the very big banks and hedge funds are getting it. Not so much because they believe in it, but they say, listen, even if these guys stand on their heads to make a big profit, you know, I did this 15 years for Goldman Sachs. I was doing all the market timing for the prop traders, and we made 40%. That was the secret of Goldman Sachs. And in the end, says, we don't know what he's doing, but it works, so let's just go with it. And they used to have blackboard, and it said, corn is bottoming on this day, wheat is bottoming on this day, they were already, and every morning they came in and see what it says on the board, we don't have to buy, and which level have to buy, how many days is going up, how many days going down, and nobody was interested why corn or wheat is going up. So to the smaller investor, I want to make it clear that nobody's interested in that stuff.
Let's look out a little bit further on the time frame, because 2015 is nearly upon us. Beyond that, sort of a 2016, 17, 18 time frame, you're not quite as bullish on the stock market, I don't believe.
I'm very bearish. I said we're going to 5,000, and we're going to be there in 2020. And the big down move is going to be from 2018 to 2020. Again, you ask me why, I have no clue. But that's going to be horrible.
You know, the short-term cycle for gold has been down for nearly 3 years. Now, what might we anticipate moving forward? The down cycle leading to an up cycle or an extension of the current trend? We personally feel that it's moving higher. Where do you land in your cycle studies?
I happen to agree in this case that our cycles, they were bottoming by the end of the summer, and we played some up moves and made some small percentages, and it's getting very close of putting in a major low. Now, you can ask me why. Gold can go up in inflation, gold can go up in deflation, gold can go up because people are afraid, gold can be anything. So I don't know why. I only know that we went out at 1900, we had a price target of 1180, and we had very long-term cycle, quarterly cycle that started to bottom after the summer. So now I'm watching it very carefully to have an entry to go long gold.
So setting aside any internal relationships, and perhaps it would be mere coincidence if there was sort of a negative correlation, equities moving lower and gold moving higher, do you see us returning to the old highs of 1920?
Yeah, we have a target of 2,100, and that crosses 3,500. They could even monetize gold and will go much higher, but we'll go step by step. I'm always afraid that people will take a mortgage on the house by call options and then lose everything if that one time it doesn't work. So I go step by step. We're looking at the next leg up, like you mentioned, maybe 50%, maybe a bit less, and the target is 2,100.
Charles Nenner felt like gold was putting in a major bottom.
That's right. And our listeners probably know his colleague, David Gerwitz, who does a lot of speaking for the Nenner Research Group, and he was on the program about a year ago. And I like these guys. Nenner came up with some models going back to the 80s. He had finished medical school and was trying to sort of map the world and understand the universe and figure out interrelationships and things of this nature. And he developed some algorithms which are at times very helpful in terms of predicting where markets are going, either on the upside or downside.
But when you talk to Nenner, it was impressive to me because every other market that he looks at, if it's going up, he buys it. If it's going down, he says sell it. But on gold, he said, hey, inflation, deflation, it doesn't matter. Gold goes up.
That's, I think, just a fundamental understanding of the role that gold has played through the years and an appreciation of various cycles where it's not axiomatic that gold goes up in inflation and goes down in deflation. As he pointed out, it actually can go up in both of those contexts and down in both of those contexts.
Gold is not copper. Let's put it that way.
It's not. But his suggestion was that you look at these cycles and there is more to the cycle cycles than you may be aware. There's a lot of embedded information that you're not going to find just in the current price. So let's talk about that current price. I mean, we've got silver, because Nenner was actually more bullish on silver in a number of recent reports than even gold, which is easy to be. You look at a 75-to-1 ratio, and you're basically looking at something that is on sale by 50%.
Well, 75 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold is what you're talking
about. Right. With the average being closer to 30, it makes it very compelling. Well, look at this. Your annual silver production is about 800 million ounces. 800 million ounces is your annual silver production. That's the physical silver market. Out of that 800 million ounces a year, you've got your industrial demand, you've got your investor demand, you've got all the different normal demand. Now you know supply and demand for the silver market. It's pretty basic. But what you don't appreciate is that the COMEX futures traders move in and out of silver to the tune of 1.1 billion ounces a day. Okay, so let's look at this. 800 million annual ounces versus 1.1 billion ounces per day.
There's no connection almost.
Right. So who's driving the price? It's COMEX futures traders. Meanwhile, we're seeing very interested demand in silver and gold all over the world. What's our gauge for interest in the physical metals? Our gauge is looking at the premiums you pay to own the real stuff.
Right.
In China today, you're paying 22% premiums for silver over Western prices. And if you look at Western prices, you're already paying premiums here. So, I mean, literally, as you go around the world, you want to own it, here's the market price. And it's very different than what's reflected on COMEX. Should I be discouraged by that? Should I conclude that, well, gosh, I guess then the price of silver will always and ever only go down? Come on. Really? Just what moved the price from $375 to $49? Things go up, things go down. Nenner's point is you have these cycles in place and you want to appreciate what's in the process of happening to these cycles. Where are we at the cycle presently? At a low. Well, gracious me, that makes sense. We should sell everything we have. No. That's the insanity of the market speaking. That's the insanity which investors sometimes subject themselves to as a response to difficult circumstances.
Well, Dave, the fact that 1.1 billion ounces are traded daily on paper, yes, it does affect the price, but we know that the mint, the U.S. mint, has been straining just to keep up with demand. I mean, they're selling millions of silver eagles. That's not even counting the Royal Canadian Mint.
What we have in the futures market is capitulation selling, and it continues to drag the price down. What we have in the physical market is aggressive buying because people are inspired by lower prices. It's a normal human value equation. You buy things when they're cheap, sell them when they're expensive. If your head's screwed on straight. Now, I would argue that the primary weakness in the precious metals market is with futures traders. And those futures traders, what are they doing? They are engaging in a set of conclusions which ultimately tie out to abnormal, unhealthy, and unstable behaviors in the marketplace. We have far too much confidence placed in the banking system today with off-balance sheet financing of up to $75 trillion. We have confidence in the dark pool trading, which is now so common. We have confidence in central banks who are now getting rebates for trading equity futures. Okay. But we have confidence in too big to fail institutions who were defined as the problem in 2008 and are now anywhere from 20 to 70% larger as a singular institution. We have confidence. And again, you look at the equity markets today, the stock markets and where they're at, you see assets priced to perfection. And that is largely dependent on the Fed's willingness to not only spend their capital, real physical capital, but also their verbal intervention capital, if you will, to drive the prices higher. They are dependent on creating a bubble to get us out of this mix and mess. And the reality is what they're going to end up with is the largest bust of all time.
I think some people see that bust coming and want to dismiss themselves or move away from it. You know, we talked about Greenspan a little earlier, but you know, when you watch Greenspan came in as the Federal Reserve Chairman in the year I started working here, Dave, 1987. And I remember Paul Volcker stepping down and Greenspan taking over, but Greenspan created and fueled, he can't deny this, he fueled the largest bubbles in world history, and one of them was the tech stock bubble. And I remember when he wanted to dismiss himself from that, about 1998, he came out with this phrase, irrational exuberance. He said, the markets are displaying irrational exuberance. Now, sure enough, we did have a severe crash in March of 2000 in the tech stock bubble, and frankly, the NASDAQ has never even gotten back in the 14 years since that happened, back to the level that it crashed from. Now, with Greenspan also stepping down in 2006, he had fueled the largest real estate bubble in history. And then he stepped aside and he gave the Fed over to Bernanke. Now, with him now saying interest rates are going to be considerably higher, gold's going to be considerably higher, but the one thing we haven't talked about yet, Dave, is the quote that this quantitative easing, this money printing, has created a tinderbox that's waiting to be lit. He's saying things that should chill people to the spine.
Right. Listen, this is one of the most fascinating times to be an investor, to be alive. And it can also be one of the most frustrating times because for the thinking individual, you look at risk and reward, and there's far more risk in the marketplace today than reward on offer. You look at interest rates, and they've been bought down through direct monetization, both corporate bonds, sovereign bonds. Now you've got central banks buying stocks, 14 different central banks buying stocks.
Directly intervening in the equities market.
And again, that helps asset prices, but what it underscores for the student of economic history is how unhealthy the markets actually are. You don't get direct monetization of corporate bonds, sovereign bonds, and stocks until you are in the last phase of catastrophe. What we're doing, if you're looking at catastrophe math, you and I have talked about this, you stack up a pile of sand and each grain adds pressure, but it seems to be stable. And you add more sand to your sand pile and it seems to be stable. Just imagine what happens. You don't know what grain of sand it is that hits the top and automatically half of the mountain sloughs off.
Right. Well, you've talked about that in relation to avalanche as well.
We have the perfect context for not only a sharp decline in the equity markets, but a financial collapse. And you have to appreciate the role that very assets play in the context of collapse. Cash, gold, these things have value. Real estate and illiquidity, there's a penalty to pay for illiquidity. You want as much flexibility as possible, and a combination of cash and gold is the perfect approach to a crisis environment. Now, again, central banks have convinced the general public that their activism is sufficient, and in fact, we can print our way to financial success. But this has never worked in the history of mankind. This has never worked in the history of mankind. Let me be just mildly pedantic for a moment. Repeat after me. Money printing doesn't work.
Money printing does not work.
Money printing doesn't work.
It never has.
Now, and this is the context that we're in, because we're not talking about a small amount of money printing. We're talking about money printing that's going directly to propping up asset prices to create an impression amongst investors that all is well. You look at the bond market and low rates suggest that there's little risk. You look at the equity markets, high prices suggest a return to economic strength. But when you look at the money printing and where it's flowing, 14 central banks buying in the stock market, getting rebates. Central banks getting rebates for trading in equity futures. This is insane. When you look at them directly purchasing corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, REITs, direct monetization of government bonds. Again, there is an appearance that all is well, but that appearance is bought and paid for by the next generation, because guess what? The money printing and debt that we're accruing, it's all well and good for this generation of investors, because guess what you get? Your balance sheet just improved. Guess what the next generation gets? You see the point?
Oh, absolutely.
This is criminal in nature, and we are, on the basis of pragmatism, willing to engage in criminal behavior and look the other direction as the world's central bankers create a bankruptcy for the next generation, create a zero balance in terms of an inheritance, so that we can live the life that we want to live, so that we can have the asset prices that we want to have, so that we can pretend that all is well. This is one of the greatest travesties of financial market history.
Well, and Richard Duncan brought out that this is not out of ignorance. Okay, a lot of these guys understand. They honestly know the outcome is, well, in Richard Duncan's words, unsurvivable unless they continue to do this. And so isn't that the description of why a bubble forms in the first place? I mean, a bubble doesn't have to get bigger and bigger and bigger if it's not a bubble. But if it is a bubble, they have to continue to keep it inflated.
I grant you, if Duncan is right, that this is a lesser of two evils. creating a bubble which may cause a financial collapse that we haven't seen, and again, in recorded financial history. Is that a better alternative to World War III? Because as Duncan suggested last week, our only problem at this point, this stage in the game...
There's nobody big enough to fight us that doesn't have a nuke, is what he said.
Right, because in times past, that's exactly what you would have done at this point in time. If you were one of the mandarins pulling the strings in one of the major centers of influence and power in the world, right about now, you can rally the troops and you can rally the entire population around a very popular theme. What's that popular theme? We're going to war. The enemy has struck. We've got to respond. And guess what you get? You get a justification of inflation. You get a justification of accrued debt. You get a justification which the general public says, I'm okay with it because we have to do our patriotic duty. To question, it would be treason. It would be tantamount to treason. We don't have the right size army to fight against. We don't want to go to nuclear war. So what are the central banks of the world doing? They're printing our way towards a facade of success. Challenging, frustrating. There's many ways of describing this particular period of time as an investor. But I would suggest to you, you should not lose your nerve. Continue to think, process, and choose wisely the assets that you want to own.
Don't bend the map.
Don't bend the map. Don't redefine reality to what appears or feels like crisis. Process this as best you can in a rational and reasonable way. Be the jockey, not the horse. Control the horse. Use the energy of the markets as they should be used, but don't be abused or crushed by them. We are in a grand experiment here, which has never ended well. This looks and feels like other periods of experimentation of a monetary nature, which have, in history, every single one of them failed. So should you lose your nerve? No. Should you own gold and silver? Absolutely. Should you add at these prices? With both fists. Should you reduce your exposure in the equity markets, bond markets, and increase a cash position? By all means. This is a period of time where you stay rational, calm, engaged, appreciate the world for what it is, appreciate the opportunities that we have today and will have tomorrow, but be very prudent and very wise about how you're spending your dollars and investing your wealth.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney with additional comments from Charles Ninner. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.